Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder. Today the topic is William Dembski and the Intelligent Design Movement. And guess who I have? None other than William Dembski. Let me tell you about Dr. Dembski. He holds two doctorates, one in mathematics and one in philosophy. He's professor of science and culture at Southern Evangelical Seminary, which is where I got my master's and currently working on my doctorate. He has authored or edited 20 books, including his first book on intelligent design titled The Design Inference. He lectures widely on intelligent design and has appeared on numerous radio and television programs. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dembski.
Good to be with you, HC.
Just to give you, the audience, a brief background, you happen to be in town teaching a class on intelligent design, which I am now taking for my doctorate class, which is why I was able to convince you to come into my studio, so I'm very, I didn't think I would ever be able to do it, but I got you in here. So let's just get started. What is intelligent design?
Right. I would define it as the study of patterns in nature that are best explained as the result or product of intelligence. So if you're driving through Southwest South Dakota and you see a rock formation that looks like Teddy Roosevelt, Abe Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, you're not going to think that wind and erosion did that. You know, just by looking at that structure and seeing the pattern that's there, that you're dealing with an intelligent cause. You may know nothing about the artist, that would be Goodson Berglum, who did that, but you still could figure out that there was an intelligence behind that. And there are lots of areas of human inquiry where we make a point of distinguishing between the effects of, if you will, chance and necessity, natural causes versus intelligent causes. So, you know, insurance investigation. You know, was that arson or was it just, you know, a random fire that happened? Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Is that signal from outer space that's coming to us, that radio signal, is that the result of an intelligent alien being or is it just random radio noise? There's a book by a fellow named Nate Silver who's very good at predicting elections, baseball and things. It's called The Signal and the Noise. And we do this all the time. You know, there's noise and there's a signal. Can we distinguish them? So that's what intelligent design tries to do, where it gets controversial. It's really a lot of areas it's not controversial, but where it does get controversial is when you start saying, okay, are there ways of detecting design and then focusing them on biology? Because if life itself is designed, you know, most of the cases I described are the instances of human designers or other alien designers who could have conceivably evolved by natural forces. But if life itself is designed, then who or what is the designer? Because you no longer have that option of, well, you know, it's just a human design. In that case, it would be an unevolved designer. And that's where things get really dicey because, you know, then who or what can that designer be? And it very quickly pushes you to theological issues. I mean, the designer, the ultimate designer, most people would say is God. So, and indeed, that's why the materialistic, atheistic evolutionist wants to stop that avenue right from the get-go and argue that indeed there's no design in biology, that it's all the result of purposeless material forces. Mainly the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations.
Right.
So the intelligent design, and there are a lot of special sciences, a lot of cases where it's uncontroversial, but it does get controversial when the question of design in biology is raised. There's also a question of cosmological design that's less controversial. It's looking for features of the universe that point to design, but in biology it's especially controversial.
Okay. Now you are one of the central figures of the ID movement. You've been there since its infancy, which is another reason why I'm glad to have you on. So you are in a position to give us then a brief history of the ID movement.
Right. Well, I would say it starts in the mid-80s with various critiques of evolution and origin of life scenarios. There's the mystery of life's origin by Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson, and then Michael Denton's Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. this book of Pandas and People by Dean Kenyon. So these were in the 80s, looking at criticisms of mainstream evolutionary thinking and then also raising the possibility of a design alternative. Things really get going in the early 90s with Philip Johnson, a legal scholar at Cal Berkeley, who writes a book, Darwin on Trial. And he gets into that because he's an expert in criminal law, and when he's starting to entertain doubts about Darwinian theory, he's engaging these evolutionists, and he sees them stonewalling in the same way that he sees criminals stonewalling on the witness stand. And so he's saying, what gives here? And so when he's cross-examining them, he's finding that they're not giving him straight answers. And so he was a brilliant guy. I mean, he's still alive, but he pulled together a whole community of scholars. And I think one of the things that had prevented informed criticism of Darwinian theory from developing in the past is just that people were so isolated that they just get shot down and neutralized. If you saw a movie, Ben Stein documentary called Expelled, you see what has happened to some of the proponents of intelligent design even in recent years. I mean, we still get nailed and hit pretty hard, but there is now a community of support, so that at least if we lose our jobs, have our reputation damaged, we're still able to keep moving forward. Phil really tied things together. He got us connected on the internet. This was back in 93. He got us talking to each other. And that was big. I mean, this was before the web, before email was really a whole big deal. And so he just kept accumulating more and more scholars, scientists, and I think the movement kind of congealed in a group called the Discovery Institute out in Seattle. It's a Seattle think tank, and especially their Center for Science and Culture. Steve Meyer heads that up. He wrote a wonderful book in 2009 titled "The Signature in the Cell." And so there's been it's just kept growing, you know. And we keep attracting talent. It's not as fast as I would like to see, because I think, among other things, there's just tremendous pressure on coming on board with intelligent design. In most scientific endeavors, if you're trying to develop a research program, it's nice to have public funding available. If you get into this area, you can do research in it, you can get a degree in it, and then you have a job waiting for you. In intelligent design, that tends not to happen. I mean, people who, I get lots of emails from students who want to do intelligent design, but basically the usual way these emails go is, you know, how can I keep what I'm doing secret so that they don't keep me from, you know, graduating? And then so I can work in these areas, but, you know, do it in a way where I don't let all my cards on the table. So that's, I don't know how many emails I've gotten from people that says, please don't say anything about, you know, our correspondence because I'm up for tenure or something like that. So it's a pretty tricky time still.
You talked about an author yesterday in class who was working on his doctorate, or his PhD, yep, and got almost to the end, and his advisor found out that he was a ID believer, and basically he wasn't able to get his PhD.
Yeah. Yeah, and that happens. I mean, it's, I think, maybe less so now, because I think there is this community of support, and we've got various legal groups that could then jump on that also. But in his case, this was a guy named Percival Davis, and he was working with Theodosius Dobzhansky, who was a premier evolutionary thinker in the mid-20th century, and he didn't get his degree, you know, when he found out that he was a quote-unquote creationist.
Yeah, so, that's a shame. Yeah. Where do you see the movement in 10 years?
Good question. I mean, I think it can go in various ways. I mean, I think it could just be, I think we could see the dissolution of a Berlin Wall, you know, where basically, you know, it's like, you know, right now I see the evolutionists still, they're controlling all the purse strings of the National Science Foundation, NIH, they control the academy, even a lot of the Christian academy. Most ID guys cannot get jobs at most CCCU schools, Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, just because it's so thoroughly evolutionary in thinking.
But I'm saying Christian
schools. Yeah. Oh yeah. Wow. Absolutely. I mean, Baylor University, for instance, their biology department, and I like the school. I cheer for their teams. There are a lot of good programs there. I worked there for 6 years.
Yeah.
But the biology department, if you are a an undergraduate and you want to do research, so let's say because you want to, you're pre-med and you want to go and have that on your resume so that when you go apply to medical school, that'll look good. They will ask you what your interest is in intelligent design or whether you think intelligent design holds up. And if you say yes, you're not going to be doing research there that summer.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's so there's tremendous opposition. I mean, most schools, most of the prominent schools, Wheaton, Calvin, Seattle Pacific,
Westmont. Very prestigious Christian schools.
Yeah. You know, they are thoroughly evolutionary. There's, and I don't see an intelligent design. One of my colleagues, even though they can have very good credentials, getting a job there. It's just just ain't going to happen. So, you know, so the thing is, you know, with all of that, okay, I see this, you know, I'm 52, so I remember this former Soviet Union. I have relatives in Poland, in Warsaw. I have relatives in what was, at the time was West Berlin. My uncle, I was there in the 70s, saw all the propaganda and everything, you know, it looked impregnable. And, you know, you looked in the early 80s, you know, the Russians, it seemed like they were just, you know, on a roll. And yet, 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. And I could see something like that happening because the theory itself, I think much as communism, people, you know, they kept up a good front, but it just wasn't working. And I think that's what's happening with evolutionary theory. It's, you know, they're still trying to, you know, keep up a good front, but the evidence for the theory is just getting, or against the theory, is getting stronger and stronger all the time. And it's not just ID or intelligent design people who are doing this. I mean, you've got, for instance, James Shapiro, a molecular biologist at University of Chicago, who's saying this theory just doesn't work anymore. It's a 19th century theory. He's not an intelligent design proponent, but he will say that what's going on in the cell is non-Darwinian. It's cells are doing their own genetic engineering. And he looks at that and he says, this is anything but Darwinian. You've got a fellow, Thomas Nagel, very prominent philosopher, thoughtful guy at NYU, New York University. He's an atheist. Okay, but he writes a book, Mind and Cosmos, and where he says the subtitle is something like Why the Materialistic Neo-Darwinian View is Almost Certainly False.
You require that for me to read for this class.
Yeah, I require that for the doctoral students. You know, but it's so it's remarkable. So we're seeing these chinks, you know, and I could see it where this whole thing just comes tumbling down. On the other hand, you know, bad ideas have a certain persistence. I think, you know, as Christians, we like to think truth will win out, and it will eventually. You know, I think we have the book of Revelation, and yet falsehoods can get institutionalized and have tremendous staying power. You know, and we see this in many false religions, false cults, how that works. So I think one thing that's been impressed on me lately is just the power of institutions and the need to reform them and redirect them in productive ways, and that we can't just do these things as lone rangers. So I think we could see something like the Soviet Union collapse with Darwinian theory. On the other hand, we could just see still years of repression. You know? So it could go either way. I'm more optimistic, you know, about that it'll collapse. I think the evidence is just very strong and against it. You know, and the design inside the cell, I think that's where so much powerful evidence is. It just seems to be becoming stronger and more overwhelming. It's the more we know about the cell, the more our own technology is able to help us look inside the cell, the more technology we find inside the cell. So it's a remarkable sort of positive feedback loop, which to me is suggesting that you know, this case is becoming very strong.
In just a couple of minutes, make your best case for intelligent design.
Yeah. Well, I think where it has become most powerful is with the revolution of molecular biology in the last 50 years. In Darwin's day, the cell was basically a little blob of jello enclosed by a membrane. I mean, there's nothing much that distinguished the cell. What we find now when we look inside the cell is basically an automated city. I mean, it's you take the simplest cell, and it's far more complicated than any manufacturing plant that humans have ever constructed. And everything is automated in it. You've got information storage, retrieval, and processing. So, for instance, in our DNA, the human DNA, if you stretch it out, it's about 6 feet. If that DNA were a fishing line, where every millimeter had, you know, let's say about two bytes of information, something like that. It would stretch out about 500 miles. Okay,
wow.
That's in a sense, you know, if you tried to sort of expand the DNA, that's what it would be like. Thing is, it's got to be
one DNA module.
I mean, it's the DNA in our cells, each of our cells, basically stretched out is 6 feet. But the thing is, if you thought of it as a fishing line, it would be about, depending on, you know, how thin or thick it is, probably a standard fishing line would be more like about 1,000 miles. For each cell. That's what it would be equivalent to. And then it would have about, and there'd be about 6 bits of information for each millimeter. Okay, so I don't know what that comes out to in this. So that's 60 in a centimeter, so about, figure about 150 bits of information per inch, okay? Because it's, you know, basically our DNA has about, it's about 6 billion bits of information, okay? So that's
wow.
That's what it is. So that's what it would come out to. But the thing is, you think of that would fill up, that fishing line would fill up about this room, but it's got to be coiled and organized in ways where it doesn't get all tangled up and where you can get access to it, because you got to be able to read it and do all that. So basically what you have in the DNA is the most efficient and stable way of storing information that we know. Okay, it's not the smallest. IBM, for instance, has written on like zirconium the letters IBM at the atomic level. But that's a very intensive task in terms of just being able to store things efficiently, reliably. DNA is about the best that we've found. So you've got information storage, retrieval, and processing. You've got inside the cell little monorails on which little motor trucks will go around and deliver parcels. And they do it by having little zip codes or UPS labels which say, okay, deliver the parcel here or there. So you've got transportation distribution systems inside the cell. You got garbage collection. You know, all of this has to be handled. It has to be handled automatically. I think, you know, we have this sense of the cell as just you've got these blobs that are floating around. They don't know what they're doing. Now, everything is very tightly choreographed. I mean, it's a marvel of technology. And so then you ask yourself, where do these systems come from? And the thing is, these systems have a property of irreducible complexity where everything has to be in place for it to work. And so it becomes a real obstacle to evolutionary thinking to how these things could have come about. And the fact is, we have to be design engineers to understand how these systems work at all. So why is it a big stretch to think that there's real design there?
Right.
The Darwinist wants to say it's not real design. You know, it's the appearance of design. You know, but what we're finding in the cell is technology built on technology built on technology. It's remarkable.
And what have been some of the triumphs of the movement?
Well, I think one thing we've done is we've gotten our stuff published in the mainstream places. So peer-reviewed journals, monographs, gotten it outside the Christian ghetto. And I think that's been huge, because I think it's just too easy. Christianity, evangelical Christianity, if there's a big community and we can just talk to ourselves. And the point is not just to talk to ourselves, but to get outside there and really engage the other side on these questions. And so we've done that consistently. And whenever the other side has raised the bar, we've cleared the bar. So I had a book, which you mentioned at the start, The Design Inference. This was a book published with Cambridge University Press, but it was in a monograph series. It was their monographs on decision and induction. And so as a monograph, it was basically the equivalent of a journal. Okay, so it ended up being an analysis of our methods of design detection, and so it gave a statistical and logical analysis of that. But you know, after that book came out, people on the other side said, yeah, but you haven't published in any peer-reviewed biology journal, okay? This is just methodology, okay? And so Steve Meyer published a paper in a biology journal on this. Well, but that was a review paper. It was an experimental paper, okay? And so now we have a research group called the Biologic Institute, where we are publishing peer-reviewed biology journals in places like Journal of Molecular Biology and, you know, standard places. And so it's, I think we've met the challenge at every point along the way. And there's been an emerging community and of scholars and scientists. And I think we're solving interesting problems. There's a group called the Evolutionary Informatics Lab. Don't be put off by evolutionary there. The point is informatics, that's the noun, okay? It's the information. And that the question we pose is, insofar as evolution is able to do anything, it's got to be guided by information. Is that information, does it have to be externally given? Does it have an intelligent source? That's the sort of question we're asking. So in a sense, we're turning the tables on the evolutionists. They're saying no need for intelligence, and we're saying, okay, well, but insofar as evolution works at all, it's using information. Where's that information coming from? So we're pushing them on their own grounds. We've done published a lot of stuff in the engineering literature on this, which relates very much to biological concerns. So I think we have a vibrant research program that's going. It's still small on the ground. I think it would be good if we could attract a lot more talent. Part of that problem is that we don't have a lot of funding. I mean, all this research that I'm describing, Biologic Institute, Evolutionary Informatics Lab, is private funding. The Evolutionary Informatics Lab used to be at Baylor, but Baylor kicked it off its server. If you watch the film Ben Stein's Expelled, you'll see the story there. So
a Baptist university.
Yeah. I mean, it's the irony is rich, but I mean, the story there is fascinating because Bob Marks, who's headed that center, he's a very senior engineer, was for 25 years on faculty at University of Washington. His expertise is in computational intelligence, and that includes evolutionary computing. So this is his field, and so he's writing. He has this lab, and he's got other labs at Baylor. Nobody ever questioned his other labs, but then it was learned that, hey, this work might have something to do with intelligent design, and the dean emails him. I've got the email where he says, I've heard that this lab has something to do with intelligent design. Please remove it from your server. And Bob refused to do it, and then the dean just went into his server space and removed it. And Bob just said, this was unthinkable. I mean, I've been at MIT, at Princeton. I cannot imagine a school like that doing that to their faculty. And yet Baylor, as a Christian school, did that to him. So he just took it off the server. Now, basically, he has students, they're getting PhDs and master's degrees working in this area, but the official lab is off the Baylor campus. It's crazy, but the work continues, and that's, I think, the important thing, but it's with tremendous opposition.
And that brings me to my next question. You faced a lot of opposition. I mean, because you have credentials, because you have credibility, you get attacked even harder, even more, because the idea is if we could take him down, then we take down one of the inner circle of the ID movement. So you are always under attack. How do you keep motivated to keep going? Because it must get discouraging. I know, sometimes it gets discouraging. How do you keep going?
Well, I think it helps a lot to have a community of support. And that's, I think, something 20, 30 years ago, that did not exist. I mean, there are a lot of Lone Rangers who are getting killed off. So I've got Discovery Institute, I've got SES. I mean, I can look to my support base. And I think, frankly, the opposition isn't what it used to be. I mean, most of my work now, I get it published in peer-reviewed places, and the other side, they're just ignoring it. Because, I mean, I think it's really unanswerable. So I remember sending an email to one mathematician who's actually a teacher of mine at University of Chicago and saying, hey, you criticized my book here, but I've since extended that work, and we've published it in peer-reviewed literature. Why don't you deal with that? He says, well, you haven't dealt with some of these earlier criticism, so I'm not even going to read your new stuff. It's like, well, okay. But so I don't find that the attacks are as vicious as they used to be. I think it's because I think I've made my case. I don't think they can rumble with me anymore. But, I don't mean to say that even, pridefully. It's just, I've thought about these things, and I think they've just decided, we're just going to ignore it. Now, earlier, though, it was pretty nasty. I was at Baylor. I had a research center on intelligent design. The Darwinists, both in and outside Baylor, got it shut down, in very short order. I was marginalized. I think one of the things that's helped me is that, I'm now at a school where, I'm not marginalized, where my work is respected, But at Baylor, that was tough. I was basically relegated to a closet that was my office. It was embarrassing when I had people come from out of town because, I had some prominence and, just had to show them around or whatever. But the thing is, though, I think, and what has always helped me keep perspective on this, is early in my Christian walk, I was exposed to the work of Richard Wurmbrand and others who had Voice of the Martyrs, people who had really suffered for Christ, my worst worry, the thing is I had the press and there were people who were supporting me, so the worst thing that could happen is I was marginalized, insulted, and eventually my contract wasn't renewed, okay? But in Soviet Russia and other places, you'd be lucky if you were demoted from principal to janitor, worse would be is, if you ended up in the salt mines, in the Gulag. So, I've never really, when people have said you've been persecuted, I've always thought that's really not an appropriate word. I mean, it's been a lot of pressure, and I felt the pressure personally in my family, because there's spillover whenever people are doing nasty things to you. But it's not been, where I've been in jeopardy of my life, where there's been a, in jeopardy of having me taken away from my family. I've never missed a meal as a result of that, So I think we need to keep putting it in perspective, I mean, the people around the world who've suffered much more for Christ.
Right. Thank you very much for being on the show, Dr. Dembski, talking with me about your involvement in the intelligent design movement. And that will end this episode of Giving a Nast. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org. Yeah.